niece of Belgium's Leopold II. She's the aunt of the current King Philippe of Belgium and the daughter of the former King Leopold III. She's speaking to us from London, where she's been arrested with Extinction Rebellion, protesting around the climate crisis. I also want to thank Gia Brassart, who is the Congolese-Belgian activist and founder of Café Congo in Brussels. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras, Maria Tarasena. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon sets another record for new COVID-19 cases in a day. President Trump plans another in-person rally, and health experts worry it will put more people at risk of catching the virus. And a new study in Oregon shows how higher education can help solve society's problems. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 9th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. This morning, in front of Portland City Hall, Letha Winston, the mother of Patrick Kimmons, led a protest rally and march for justice. Kimmons was shot 9 times in the back and killed in downtown Portland last year. Here's an excerpt from this morning's rally.
How do officers keep getting justified when they have studied killing all of us, including the homeless, mental ill, and many, many more? When does it stop? When does the change come? As long as I'm out here 10 toes to the pavement, I can guarantee you, that I will get justice. I can guarantee you that I will get justice in due time. You wonder why these people is doing mad destruction around here. You're talking about protesters burning down justice centers, protesters burning down buildings, protesters writing on people's businesses. Well, you sit back and you ask yourself, is enough enough? It is. It's past enough. It's past enough. Out here, beating homeless people, murdering homeless people, killing murdering mentally ill people, murdering black people, murdering white people, murdering everyone because they got a gun and a badge. You delivered this message to the ones that took my son's life. You delivered this message to the one that took George Floyd's life. And the reason why I stand here 10 toes to the pavement and say that is because you choked our kids. Why wasn't you choked? You murdered our kids. Why wasn't you murdered? Do your job or get your ass out. There's no reason why you should have a job and pay tons and thousands of dollars, and we are out here from sunup to sundown screaming for justice.
43 days!
That is absolutely sick and disgusting. And I demand justice, and I demand it now, and I will get it by any means necessary. She can walk, where she can talk, where she can dance, where she can sing, where she can pray. You do not have the authority to run our lives. We own this property just like you do. I pay tax money just like you do. I refuse to be kicked off another property due to your officers gas bombing us, throwing horrible chemicals at us when we peacefully protest.
Whose streets?
Our streets.
Whose streets?
Our streets.
We are peacefully protesting. We got the right to make as much noise as we want to. I seen another press yesterday on the news talking about protesters. What in the world is you talking about protesters for? We just like you and anybody else. We came here to get justice, Ted Wheeler, and whether you like it or not, we're going to get it.
Yeah.
So don't discourage us, because we on a mission. We got a job, and it ain't done yet, but I can guarantee you it will be.
Yeah.
That was Letha Winston, the mother of Patrick Kimmons, who was shot in the back 9 times and killed by Portland police. She led about 100 protesters from Portland City Hall to the corner of Southwest 4th and Harvey Milk, where her son was killed. One more time, new COVID cases in Oregon are soaring. Hundreds of people are filing complaints about others not complying with mask-wearing orders in public, and the Pacific Islander community is getting hit especially hard. For these stories, we go to KBOO's Annette Newell with this COVID-19 local update.
The Oregon Health Authority reports 389 new cases of COVID-19 in the state today and 6 new deaths. This brings the state total to 11,188 confirmed and presumptive cases and 230 deaths. More than 281,000 Oregonians have been tested for the virus. The positive test rate has risen above 6%. Hospitalizations are also rising since June to 140. However, some hospitals in the state are reporting lower death rates, and that among those sick enough to be hospitalized, more are now surviving. Meantime, regulators in Oregon are getting hundreds of complaints about face coverings. Customers and workers are concerned about businesses not enforcing state requirements to wear face coverings in public indoor spaces. But some Oregonians are opting out of wearing them by claiming they're medically exempt. Oregon could run into shortages in the next 2 months for COVID-19 testing supplies. The Oregon Health Authority and Governor Kate Brown's office say it's becoming tougher to compete with other states for testing materials, as other states are struggling with worse outbreaks. For example, Florida, Texas, and Arizona have already had their intensive care units close to or reaching capacity. 9 labs at Oregon hospitals have already been affected by supply shortages, according to the Oregon Health Authority. Oregon has not been matching other states in testing because it is limiting the tests mostly to people with symptoms or who are in targeted groups. This week, some state lawmakers said they are working with the governor to find ways to get more testing kits and supplies and trying to keep the situation from getting worse. One option they're looking at is expanding the number of labs the state depends on to process the tests. As for those testing positive for the coronavirus in Oregon, it's taking an especially tough toll on the Pacific Islander community. Pacific Islanders have more than triple the rate of COVID-19 cases than any other communities in the state. This week, the Oregon Health Authority says there are about 190 cases of the virus per 10,000 Pacific Islanders. Black Oregonians have the next highest rate at 54.7 cases per 10,000. White people have 12 cases per 10,000 in Oregon. On a national level, the United States has now surpassed 3 million confirmed cases, more than any other country, and more than 132,000 deaths. Around the world, there have been 12 million confirmed cases and almost 550,000 deaths. Right now, Florida is seeing an alarming increase in deaths, with 120 in a single day and more than 4,000 total dead from the virus. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says that any state that is having a serious problem should, quote, seriously look at shutting down. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
A temporary law has made it illegal for food delivery apps like Grubhub and DoorDash to charge restaurants more than 10% in commission fees during the pandemic. The Portland City Council passed the legislation unanimously on Wednesday. Other cities, including Philadelphia, Seattle, and Los Angeles, have also imposed limits on how much food apps can charge restaurants. The legislation is meant to protect restaurants that are struggling to stay afloat during the pandemic. Fees can be as high as 30%, and deliveries are rising during the pandemic because of business restrictions and social distancing efforts. The Portland ruling also makes it illegal for food apps to lower the earnings of delivery drivers to offset the loss of income resulting from the cap on commission. The restriction will last for up to 90 days after Portland's state of emergency order is lifted. Currently, there's no date set for the end of that order. A public health expert is weighing in on President Trump's plans for a rally in New Hampshire this weekend. This Saturday's rally in Portsmouth would be Trump's third since the COVID-19 outbreak started. Laura Rosbrow-Tellum has more on the story.
President Donald Trump is scheduled to hold an outdoor rally in Portsmouth on Saturday, and it's raising concerns among health experts. Dr. Ben Lockwin, who consults with the CDC on COVID-19, says people have the right to express their beliefs, but he criticizes Governor Chris Sununu's decision not to require masks at Trump's event.
Whether Sununu goes ahead to not choose to proceed with a mask mandate, it would be at the peril of the community at large, because we know that that would be a situation where the likelihood of infectious spread is much higher.
The Trump campaign announcement about the rally mentions that they will hand out masks to all attendees. The event is expected to take place at Portsmouth International Airport at 8 p.m. Saturday. Lockwin describes what measures rally attendees can take to minimize risk.
Distancing beats mask use or any other measures. But in a case like this, a rally necessarily, distancing is impossible and impractical. So the use of masks and face coverings is crucial.
Few attendees at the Trump rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, wore masks or attempted to socially distance. The COVID-19 rate in New Hampshire is lower than other battleground states where the Trump campaign considered holding rallies, such as Florida and North Carolina. I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, reporting for Public News Service.
Oregon residents can now legally change their gender to non-binary. The Oregon Appeals Court decided in favor of a new law Wednesday that requires circuit court judges to grant non-binary as a gender if the person has legally followed the process to change their gender. People who identify as non-binary often see their gender as having masculine or feminine qualities, a combination, or define their gender as something else. The ruling followed an appeal by Jones Hollister, a Eugene resident who petitioned for a non-binary gender marker in 2019 and was denied by Lane County Circuit Court Judge Charles Carlson. Hollister said it's difficult to have official documents define your gender inaccurately. A non-binary gender marker is essential in supporting gender identity in organizations and companies, according to Hollister. Oregon birth certificates and driver's licenses already include an option for non-binary, but those options are not legal gender categories. The case had no opposition, so the ruling will stand and the case will not go to higher court, according to OPB. The ruling was supported by the ACLU of Oregon, the Oregon Department of Justice, and other groups. A new report finds that education after high school is the key to a stronger nation, and one foundation's goal is for 60% of Americans to have post-high school education credentials by the year 2025. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story from Portland.
New research finds more Americans have credentials beyond high school, but the country could pick up the pace on its education goals. In Lumina Foundation's latest A Stronger Nation report, tracking post-secondary attainment, including college degrees and other high-quality credentials, the organization says the U.S. also needs to close racial gaps in education. Patrick Crane is director of community colleges and workforce development with the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. He says one way Oregon is doing that is by helping folks, especially adults, pick the education path that's right for them.
These are really intended to connect folks with more hands-on advising and career coaching while connecting them to certificate programs that get them essential skills that they can use in the workplace.
According to Lumina's research, 51.3% of Americans have a degree, workplace certificate, or other high-quality credential. Oregon is slightly behind that at 50.5%. The state's goal by 2025 is to have at least 40% of residents with a bachelor's degree or above, 40% with a post-secondary credential, and 20% with a high school diploma. Lumina is working to get 60% of Americans holding credentials beyond high school by 2025. Courtney Brown with the organization says the U.S. is lagging behind other parts of the world.
While the U.S. was a longtime leader in post-secondary education, for those 25 to 34-year-olds with a post-secondary degree or credential, today we fall into 10th behind Korea, Canada, Lithuania, and the United Kingdom.
Jeff Stroll directs research at Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He says COVID-19 is complicating attainment efforts, but he adds that they will become essential.
As we've entered into this horrid pandemic recession, certifications are going to become very core to some of our reskilling and reemployment efforts.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Portland police procedures around recent protests. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, then at 8, Soul to Soul. Tonight's weather, cloudy skies and a low of 57. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 81. Today in history, on this date in 1868, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified, guaranteeing African Americans full citizenship and all persons in the United States due process of law. The quote of the day is from Pennsylvania Congressman Thaddeus Stevens, a fierce opponent of slavery and discrimination, who said, quote, "Man still is vile, but such large steps have lately been taken in the true direction that the patriot has a right to take courage." Green Party nominating convention begins today, and the U.S. Supreme Court rules President Trump is not above the law when it comes to releasing his tax returns. With more on those stories, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Close to 50% of everybody in 2016 who was eligible to vote did not vote. And it's not because they're apathetic, it's because they're alienated.
Green Party co-chair Andrea Merida thinks some of those people might be attracted to their platform. A Green New Deal, Medicare for All, a jobs guarantee, nuclear disarmament. Merida also campaign manages the Green Party's presumptive presidential ticket, candidate Howie Hawkins and his running mate for vice president Angela Walker. The Green Party convention starts today online. Merida wants people to know they're in it for the long term.
You've got people in your circles that, oh, I just can't do it. I have to hold my nose and vote for Biden because we just got to get rid of Trump. And, you know, that's important. That's an important feeling. And for me, I actually see that as a positive because it shows that people are afraid affirming what it is that we collectively need, and it's creating this kind of tug of war in there. And if they don't come with us today, that's okay. They'll come with us tomorrow.
The Greens went virtual due to the pandemic. Democrats delegates will attend their convention remotely as well next month, though some events will be live streamed from Milwaukee. At least 5 Republican senators won't attend their party's in-person convention in Jacksonville, Florida. 86-year-old Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley says for him, it's, quote, because of the virus situation. Yesterday, in 7-2 votes, the Supreme Court issued tandem religious freedom rulings. Religious teachers at faith-based schools are no longer secure from job discrimination on the basis of race, sex, age, or any other federal protections. And employers with religious or moral objections may withhold contraception from their healthcare plans, a rule the Trump administration added to the Affordable Care Act. Kaiser Family Foundation's Liz Hamel tracks public opinion on health issues.
I think most people feel that women should be able to access birth control and that, you know, accessing low or no cost birth control is really important. But when you present the argument of religious freedom from the side of employers, you get a different answer.
This fall, the court will hear the Trump administration's request to outright repeal Obamacare. Kaiser data indicates that might alienate more independent voters who could make a difference in key swing states.
When we had the debate over repeal and replace, and there was a lot more media attention brought to what it would mean if the law was taken away and how many people would lose insurance and how the protections for people with pre-existing conditions would go away, we did see more Democrats and independents having a positive view of the law.
And today the court hands down their remaining rulings, including whether Trump's tax returns can be subpoenaed by House Democrats or the Manhattan District Attorney. Here's Tulane Law Professor Steve Griffin.
Trump's just drawn a really hard line against any disclosure, and I'm just not sure that's going to work out for him in the end.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Newly released transcripts from police officer body cameras show George Floyd saying he couldn't breathe 20 times before he died. Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin killed Floyd after pressing his knee on Floyd's neck for almost 9 minutes while Floyd was face down on the ground and handcuffed. Multiple outlets are reporting that the transcripts were taken from body camera footage worn by officers Thomas Lane and J. Alexander Kang. The transcripts have been released as part of a motion to dismiss charges against Officer Thomas Lane. The transcripts show that Lane, who was holding Floyd's legs, twice asked Chauvin if they should move Floyd, and Chauvin said no. Lane's attorney said the courts should make the body camera videos public. Chauvin has been charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter. Officer Lane, Kang, and former Officer To Tao were charged with aiding and abetting second-degree murder and manslaughter. All officers have been fired and none have entered a plea. A landmark victory for Indian country in the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. House explores the impact on COVID-19 in Native communities, and Wisconsin forms a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Thursday 5-4 that Oklahoma did not have authority to prosecute a tribal citizen for crimes on reservation boundaries. The 86-page opinion by Judge Neil Gorsuch upholds treaty promises of Indian land in eastern Oklahoma. In the case McGirt v. Oklahoma, Jim C. McGirt, Seminole and Muscogee Creek, was convicted of several felony sex crimes in Oklahoma court. He asserted the crimes occurred within the boundaries of the Muscogee Reservation and that the state had no jurisdiction over him. State court denied his petition and was affirmed by an appeals court. Thursday's high court decision holds Congress did not formally undo the Muscogee Reservation. The land remains reservation for purposes of federal criminal law. McGirt potentially could be retried in federal court along with Patrick Murphy. Murphy, Muscogee Creek, was convicted of murder in Oklahoma State Court and is seeking to be heard in federal court, asserting the crime occurred within reservation boundaries and the state had no jurisdiction. The U.S. House Energy and Commerce Committee is exploring how Indian country is being impacted by COVID-19. Witnesses tell lawmakers the pandemic is showing how important broadband access needs are. Matt Laszlo has a story from Washington.
Infection rates remain high in Native communities, which is why telemedicine is essential. And despite President Donald Trump's call to reopen schools, many will be closed this fall. And Native students have struggled plugging in while at home because most don't have internet access. The lack of broadband in Indian country ripples across everything, according to Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez. He says while this administration has upended regulations for its own pet projects, it's neglected Native Americans.
If we can set aside certain policies and regulations to build a wall between Mexico and U.S., I'm sure we can do the same here in tribal communities.
California Democratic Congresswoman Anna Eshoo says congressional Republicans need to stand up to the president in order to get him to right these wrongs.
These are not issues that we don't know how to address. It's a matter of political will.
Congress is out for the next 2 weeks, but when they're back, infrastructure is expected to be the talk of the town, though tribal leaders are hoping Native needs become a central part of those debates. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call recently announced the formation of a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. That's good news to a state legislator who helped author the bill to bring about the task force. Ken Kroll reports.
There was a meeting in Lac des Flambeaux last fall to announce the effort to form a task force. Democratic State Senator Janet Buley of Delta was joined by State Representatives Beth Myers and Amanda Stock at the meeting. Representative Jeff Mercer of Krivitz also co-sponsored the bill. Buley says after the measure was introduced in the legislature, it died there, so she was pleased to see Call bringing it back.
I'm thrilled that the Attorney General agrees with quite a few of the people in the Native community and law enforcement throughout the area that we need to find a way to understand what this problem is.
Buley says they need more data to understand the scope of the problem and to face the issue. Getting the right people on the task force is important.
What's significant is representation, not only by tribal communities themselves, but by women who have been exploited. And I know that there are women out there who are brave and will come forward and help us with their stories and the information.
Native American women are murdered and sexually assaulted at rates as high as 10 times the average in certain counties in the United States.
That was Ken Kroll reporting, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 9th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Piper McDaniel, Jenka Soderberg, and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Laura Rossbrow-Tellum, Antonia Gonzalez, and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Full Omath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programming, including the evening news, is made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
We'll be right back.
yesterday, on Wednesday, June 8th, the Portland Police Bureau held a press conference to discuss their approach to ongoing protests against racial injustice and police brutality that have taken place over the past month and a half. The presentation was led by the Portland Police's Deputy Chief Chris Davis. Davis focused on the acts of violence toward Portland police officers and damage done to buildings, including the Multnomah Justice Center. Today, I'll be highlighting the key takeaways from yesterday's press conference, including questions asked by myself and fellow reporters. And to gain a better understanding of the legal rights of Portland protesters, I've invited longtime local criminal defense and civil rights attorney Kenneth Krusher, who is taking part in representing Portland journalists filing a class action lawsuit against law enforcement in the Multnomah County Circuit Court of Oregon, to quote, stop law enforcement officers from engaging in collective punishment of lawful, nonviolent, and or passively resistant protesters and those documenting the Black Lives Matter protests in Portland, Oregon, end quote. By far, the biggest criticism of the Portland police and law enforcement response to protests and demonstrations has been the very reason many peaceful protesters are showing up to the protests: law enforcement's use of force. Excessive force has been a problem in the past for the Portland Police Department. In 2017, they reached a settlement with the Department of Justice regarding excessive force used on people experiencing mental illness. More recently, the advocacy group Don't Shoot Portland sued the Portland Police Department over its use of tear gas on protesters. A court ruled in Don't Shoot Portland's favor, putting an injunction on the use of tear gas, or CS gas, by Portland police. That means the court told the cops they must limit its use, since it impacts not only agitators, but nonviolent protesters as well. A second major criticism has been that these uses of force have impacted non-protesters living their everyday lives, whether staying home during the pandemic or commuting in their cars. How and when the police decide to tear gas a crowd is important, not only because of the court order, but because of the collateral impacts on people in the area. The Portland Mercury's Alex Zielinski inquired in that decision-making process.
I kind of want to pull back on the way you were describing protesters versus agitators, the east side versus the west side kind of dynamic. I'm curious if there are people who protest outside the Justice Center who aren't engaging in violence or not committing a crime. What's the thinking that goes into the decision to use CS gas indiscriminately on those groups?
So the question is, what's the thinking that goes into the use of CS gas on a group where, obviously, at any given time, not everybody in that group is engaged in criminal activity? And that, you just hit on one of the most challenging things about dealing with these events, Alex. And that's why things have to have gotten to a level where life safety is at risk, either risk of injury or worse to either the public or to police officers. So things that we look for, what's the level of that risk? And it's not a check-the-box kind of assessment. It is an individual assessment based on the totality of the circumstances. But in general, the reason why we'll end up using CS gas is because we're encountering really sustained violence, usually by things being thrown at us, like all the things that you've seen in the videos today, and fires being lit. And then to address the issue of indiscriminate use, obviously we don't want to use CS gas at all. I don't like it. I don't like myself as a professional police officer for the last 26 years, I don't like the idea of having to use something like that in our community. But what we try to do to mitigate the effects on people who aren't engaged in the criminal activity is give, as I said before, as many warnings as we can, along with as specific of instructions as we can of which way to leave, and make sure that we give people the chance to leave. Where it really gets challenging, and where I would ask for the community's help, is when people, despite the fact that we are announcing that it's gotten so bad that we're about to use CS gas, they choose to stay there anyway. By that point, we have the authority under Oregon law and the city code to disperse the crowd based on what we're seeing. And so what would really help us avoid that is some cooperation from folks who are there who no longer want to be part of the event. And even if you're somebody who maybe has been throwing things, if you choose to leave when we disperse the crowd, you can do that. There's nothing that says that you have to stay there. But you know, it's a matter of really all of us cooperating with each other to be able to have people go out and express their First Amendment rights without coming to the point where, you know, we have a risk of fire in a neighborhood, or we have a risk of getting an officer seriously injured or killed, or a community member seriously injured or killed. You know, we've seen some incidents where some of these fireworks don't quite get thrown far enough and wind up blowing up right next to other people in the crowd. When the danger level gets to that point, if it's a choice between deploying CS gas or having a fatality, I would prefer that you didn't, not you, but I would prefer that we weren't put in the position of having to make that choice at all in the first place.
In the following clip, you will hear Deputy Chief Davis describe the Portland Police Bureau's crowd management tactics, which, among many other things, has been scrutinized for targeting the crowd of peaceful protesters at large instead of the small group of folks whom Davis calls agitators, who are committing the acts of violence towards law enforcement.
It's actually been very intentional. And it's really more a matter of event policing than crowd management or crowd control. Those are sort of outdated terms. Because policing an event can be anything from not showing up at all, because there's just no reason for us to, all the way up to having to engage in some of the more hands-on activities that you're seeing in some of these videos. Usually, as I said earlier, for some of these really large actual protest groups, not showing up at all worked just fine, because these were really well-organized events and they didn't need us to make their point. But when we've tried that with the agitator group, they have responded by escalating and escalating and escalating until we can no longer avoid getting involved, because something really bad is going to happen if we don't get involved. We tried that with this group. It just hasn't worked. A lot of times we will have we'll have success at trying to work with organizers to facilitate free speech events. We do that all the time. We get varying degrees of interest in engaging with us on that. But this works really well with actual First Amendment events a lot of times, because we're able to facilitate traffic control for demonstrators' safety. And we have found that when we're able to work together, these events tend to be very successful. But this does not work with this agitator group at all. They will not engage us. At one point, when we were trying to address the night after night issue in the park out here, we tried just stationing officers in the park, just in regular uniforms, just to be out there as a police presence to see if that would have a calming effect on people coming into the park for the evening. And it really didn't work very well. We ended up getting a group of officers surrounded by a pretty hostile crowd and having to extract themselves from that. Like I mentioned before, we tried retreating into the Justice Center and just not engaging the crowd, but to keep up that constant escalation until it would be irresponsible of us in terms of our public safety responsibilities not to go address the issue. We get asked a lot of times, why don't you just go arrest the people who are doing the bad stuff in the back of the crowd? We would like to do that, but that is extremely challenging because of some of the tactics that we see get used. Those tactics are designed to make it very difficult for us to get to those people. They're designed to put people often with their hands up in between police officers and the people launching things at them. And it really is difficult to do that without significant use of force and significant risk of injury to everyone involved. So, you know, there are other ways to try to do follow-up and make cases on people. You can see how masked up people are and how hard it is to identify anyone in a lot of these crowds, so that's pretty challenging. We do try to remove graffiti immediately whenever possible, because just leaving it there, and it's actually been very intentional. And it's really more a matter of event policing than crowd management or crowd control. Those are sort of outdated terms. Because policing an event can be anything from not showing up at all, because there's just no reason for us to, all the way up to having to engage in some of the more hands-on activities that you're seeing in some of these videos. Usually, for, and as I said earlier, for some of these really large actual protest groups, not showing up at all worked just fine, because these were really well-organized events and they didn't need us to make their point. But when we've tried that with the agitator group, they have responded by escalating and escalating and escalating until we can no longer avoid getting involved, because something really bad is going to happen if we don't get involved. We tried that with this group. It just hasn't worked. A lot of times we will have we'll have success at trying to work with organizers to facilitate free speech events. We do that all the time. We get varying degrees of interest in engaging with us on that. But this works really well with actual First Amendment events a lot of times, because we're able to facilitate traffic control for demonstrators' safety. And we have found that when we're able to work together, these events tend to be very successful. But this does not work with this agitator group at all. They will not engage us. At one point, when we were trying to address the night after night issue in the park out here, we tried just stationing officers in the park, just in regular uniforms, just to be out there as a police presence to see if that would have a calming effect on people coming into the park for the evening. And it really didn't work very well. We ended up getting a group of officers surrounded by a pretty hostile crowd and having to extract themselves from that. Like I'd mentioned before, we tried retreating into the Justice Center and just not engaging the crowd, but to keep up that constant escalation until it would be irresponsible of us in terms of our public safety responsibilities not to go address the issue. We get asked a lot of times, why don't you just go arrest the people who are doing the bad stuff in the back of the crowd? We would like to do that, but that is extremely challenging because of some of the tactics that we see get used. Those tactics are designed to make it very difficult for us to get to those people. They're designed to put people, often with their hands up, in between police officers and the people launching things at them. And it really is difficult to do that without significant use of force and significant risk of injury to everyone involved. So, you know, there are other ways to try to do follow-up and make cases on people. You can see how masked up people are and how hard it is to identify anyone in a lot of these crowds, so that's pretty challenging. We do try to remove graffiti immediately whenever possible, because just leaving it there.
Up next is attorney Kenneth Krusher, and answers why he is representing local journalists in a class action lawsuit regarding the use of force by law enforcement, and explains why the use of CS gas is not only morally wrong to use on a crowd of mostly peaceful protesters, but actually illegal in the state of Oregon. It's taking place.
Sure. So three independent journalists just filed a lawsuit as representative plaintiffs in a class action. The lawsuit is not just focused on independent journalists. Instead, the lawsuit is focused on everyone who has attended the demonstrations and the protests in Portland in the last 40 days or so since the murder of George Floyd. And the lawsuit's focused mostly on people that have suffered at the hands of law enforcement the use of force, crowd control force, when folks are either nonviolently, peacefully protesting in the crowd, or at most engaged in some form of passive resistance, right? And so the independent journalists that are in the crowd are a great example of people that are in the crowd and that are there lawfully, and many of whom have suffered the use of force. And when I say suffered use of force, what I'm referring to, of course, is people that have been tear gassed and shot indiscriminately and randomly with rubber bullets, have had, you know, threats of force used against them, have been pepper sprayed, you know, flashbangs used against them, those sort of things. You know, and that refers to people that were downtown that have been walking away from the protests and have been kind of chased down, either on foot or by officers on foot or by officers in cars, and have had use of force against them. You know, what I mean by that is essentially people that are walking away from a protest, and as they're walking away from a protest, you know, cars and trucks full of law enforcement, mostly Portland Police Riot Police, have driven by and thrown, you know, riot control munitions at them as they're walking away, for example. Or for folks that are downtown, you know, let's say in one of the parks, at a rally and a demonstration, observing, reporting on the events, participating in the events, and the police will then tear gas the crowd. Right? Because what's been happening here is essentially the police have been using the actions of a few people as justification for attacking an entire crowd, And what the lawsuit is for is that those actions, those uses of force under Oregon law are unlawful. Right? What Oregon law says, what the law in most jurisdictions say essentially, is that police can use force against people where there's an individualized reason to believe the use of force is necessary. Not just that person has broken the law, but the police have to use force that's necessary in that situation. And so if you have a crowd of people, and if police see somebody that is, you know, throwing a rock, throwing a bottle or whatnot, what the law would say is that police could go in and arrest that person. In the process of arresting that person, if that person was resisting or whatnot, the police could use reasonable force to arrest that person. Police can't use force to punish that person, can't use force to punish other people around that person, and can't use force to essentially disperse or arrest or harm the entire crowd because of the actions of that person.
So if I can interrupt you, oh, sorry, go ahead.
And cannot use force against the entire crowd to punish that crowd or to arrest that crowd or to disperse that crowd because of the actions of that single person. And that's very much what the police have been doing. You know, most of the people that have been arrested at the protests in the last, 40-some days here in Portland, 40 days or so in Portland, have been charged with the crime of interfering with a peace officer. And what the officers are arguing, what they would say, is that they gave an order to the crowd to disperse, and then when people didn't leave, that was a lawful order, and that they arrested people for it.
Another area of concern is how dispersal of crowds impacts journalists covering protest events. Up next, an important correction to note in the following next question, asked by myself, you will hear Deputy Chief Davis be asked about a statement he made. In actuality, this is incorrect. Deputy Davis did not make this statement, and the question was based off a video statement made by Portland Police Public Information Officer Tina Jones.
Thank you. Hi, Clara Schotter with KBOO News again. I was wondering, Deputy Chief Davis, can you clarify a statement that was made in a video statement by you that stated members of the press do not have a right to document protests once a dispersal order has been made?
I don't remember saying that, and if I did, then that would have been a mistake on my part.
If it was a mistake, sorry to interrupt you, can you clarify whether or not that is an accurate statement, whether or not we're made by you or not?
So I said that members of the press are not allowed to document
a protest once a dispersal order has been
once
made?
A dispersal order. Again, I'm not... That rests on the assumption that I said that, but if I actually said that, we encourage members of the press to document news, and I just sent out an internal email actually yesterday reminding officers that members of the media have a job to do. Now, members of the press in general, up until the most recent temporary extreme, we're not exempted from the law that says that people have to leave an area when lawfully ordered to do so. But I'd be interested if you can show me where I said that on video, because if I said that, that would have been a mistake on my part.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everybody. We appreciate you being here today.
Everton Bailey with the Oregonian asks about the consequences of using CS gas, aka tear gas, and how the majority of folks impacted by tear gas are either nonviolent protesters or are not even protesters at all. The majority of the press conference focused on violent acts committed against police officers. Crowd control devices like CS gas or rubber bullets are only supposed to be used when there is a threat to, quote, life safety. Davis says officers have been hit by water bottles, rocks, and fireworks. I wanted to know more about how officers have been injured and how serious those injuries were.
Sarah Shada with KBU News. You've mentioned the various ways that officers have been attacked, from mortars, frozen water bottles, all those things that you've listed. Can you tell us how officers have been injured and how many have been hospitalized?
I think it depends on what you mean by hospitalized. I know we have had to send a few to the hospital. I'm not going to talk about specifics of employee injuries because I cannot give specific details of this officer sustained this injury and had this medical treatment. But in general, as I said before, we've had officers injured by things that are thrown at them, and we've seen a fair number of hearing-related injuries because of fireworks that were thrown at them, and then problems with eyes from having lasers shining in their eyes.
And you mentioned that earlier with the green lasers, so that has caused damaging effects. Can you describe for officers or anyone in general how that would manifest into an injury?
Some ways that might manifest into an injury is trouble seeing.
Obviously, but like for how long would your vision be delayed, for example?
I don't have enough medical knowledge to know, and I think it's a function of how close they were to the laser and how long they were exposed to it.
And just to clarify, there have been folks in varying degrees, officers, have been hospitalized?
I know that we have sent officers to the hospital. No hospital admissions thus far, and that's one thing that obviously we're very thankful for because it certainly could have happened. We've been very lucky.
Great, thank you.
Crucier wraps up this conversation, recognizing that the job of law enforcement is difficult, and officers clearly face challenges every night. However, he says, this is not an excuse to use military-style weapons on crowds that at large are protesting against police violence.
I was just gonna say, how do you respond then to officers such as mentioned yesterday in the press conference that officers are doing their job the best they can, as some would say, coming from the Portland Police Bureau? And not only that, something that was mentioned was that it's too challenging to find a way to arrest the agitators, as they are called, who are causing violence, who are causing harm by throwing fireworks, all types of munitions, frozen water bottles, etc. How do you respond then to that, as our discussion has been going, how it seems that often the overall group is being punished versus the agitators?
Well, the job of law enforcement in protest situations is, of course, a difficult one. Right? And it's difficult in a lot of situations, and they know it's difficult, and there's difficult questions to be made, difficult policy choices, difficult questions about, like, how are we going to try to, how are they going to try to enforce the law, if that's what, that's their goal, which of course it is, right? And how are they going to deal with crowds of people who are angry for a good reason? Anyone that saw the video of George Floyd's murder, across the political spectrum, I think has to recognize that people's anger is justified. So, I mean, there's no doubt the choices are difficult. The question is, of course, is that justification for them to then use force unlawfully? And of course, what the law says is no, right? Just because police are difficult, just because it would be easier, if you have a crowd of 100 people and 5 people in that crowd are committing a crime, simply partially because it would be easier to tear gas or randomly terrorize an entire crowd. That is no justification, whether it's moral justification, ethical justification, or certainly legal justification for the police engaging in collective punishment. Right? Mm-hmm. We are not at war. The police should not be at war with the crowd. This is not, that is the sort of kind of logic that, you know, countries use when they're at war. You know, it's too difficult to pick out the other side's, to pick out the enemy, so we had to bomb the entire city. That's not how we as a society want police to be acting. And quite frankly, that's not how the law says the police can act. So is their job difficult? Well, yes, of course their job's difficult. But is that any justification for the police? You know, because it's difficult or because it would be easier to you know, attack the entire crowd of people because the actions of two people, is that justification for them attacking the entire crowd? Well, no, certainly not. If anything, it's kind of an admission from the police that, you know, I think that a lot of the police officers know that what they're doing is wrong. Right? They know that they should not be tear gassing the entire crowd. And the only way they can do that is by deciding in their mind that everybody in that crowd is the enemy. And that, of course, is not how, as a society, as a city, we want our police to act. And it's not how the law allows them to act.
This is Claire Rosciato with KBOO News in Depth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.